dated April 24, 2025, 9 a.m. We have a quorum. First item on the agenda is adoption of the minutes from April 23. Are there any corrections to the minutes? There are none. The minutes are adopted. First item on the agenda today is Senate File 3228. Senator Frentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate the opportunity to present Senate File 3228. Always an honor to come before Tax Committee members. Want to start by saying this bill is about a simple matter of not how much, but when sales tax is remitted to the state of Minnesota. I'm sure every member of the committee has had a chance to visit a game with a friend. Look at these guys. The issue before you is when sales tax is due and owing to the state of Minnesota on behalf of many of our professional sports franchises. Whether you're attending a game at the University of Minnesota Duluth, Mendota Heights, whether you're going to a Twins game, those memories can't have a price tag on them. For that reason, let's be good partners with the entities that provide this entertainment, that give us these great childhood moments, and stick to the tax principles that this committee has long fought for, including the accrual method of accounting and the timing of sales tax remittance. What does Senate File 3228 do? It basically says that under the accrual method, sales taxes are due when the event occurs that gives the team the right to hold on to the cost of the ticket. Here's an example. Let's say Senator Housechild buys a ticket to see the Minnesota Wild, who are likely to win the Stanley Cup this year, but never mind that. Senator Housechild pays for that ticket 6 months before the game. Senator Housechild has the right to go to that game, but that game may be canceled. That game may be postponed. The team does not have the right to take that revenue until the game's actually played. If the team selects the accrual method, which they have, and which is allowed under the IRS regs, the State Department of Revenue rules, and our Minnesota statutes 297A, Senator Housechild goes to the game. Now the team has the right to keep the money. They don't have to refund it. Therefore, the sales tax should be due and owing at this point. Why, you ask, is this file necessary? Because we are simply asking the Tax Committee members to clarify that the teams owe the money when the game has been played. To do it the other way would be to suggest that they remit sales tax on a game for which they may never play and for which they're ultimately obligated to refund the money to the season ticket holder. But don't just take my word for it, Mr. Chair. I have with me Kate Chablowski, the Chief Financial Officer of the Minnesota Vikings. We are here on behalf of these entities, including our beloved Vikings, the Twins, the Wild, the Loons, the Timberwolves, who are also going to win the NBA championship this year. That, too, is not germane to this bill. And I'd like Mr. Chair to have her give a bit of testimony.
Thank you, Senator Frentz. Before we go to that, can I ask a question on the bill? We've had kind of a theme in the Taxes Committee that at times the Department of Revenue has reinterpreted existing statute, which led to a tax liability for customers or businesses. Is this a similar situation where there was an existing interpretation of sales tax remittance, which was then changed?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that. I know that your time's valuable, but since you ask, the teams have always remitted the sales tax in accordance with what Senate File 3228 asks you to make clear. But it is true that the Department of Revenue had a question about the timing and that this bill comes before you primarily because the Department of Revenue has recognized that there's a different interpretation. Glad to report, I believe the Department of Revenue is neutral on this bill and we have worked with them to try to find some common ground, and I believe this bill represents the best. My testifier may know the exact date of the Department of Revenue guidance on that.
Ms. Chablowski, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kate Chablowski, Chief Financial Officer of the Minnesota Vikings. I'm also representing all of the major sports teams in the market. That is correct that we have been working with the department, and it was, I believe, back in 2015 that we had started this conversation. Sorry.
Proceed with any testimony that you have.
Thank you. So yes, as noted, the sports teams and entertainment venues have been accounting for sales tax on the accrual basis for both income tax and sales tax since the beginning of our respective league operations. This means we remit sales tax as the games are played. I think critical to the discussion of the accrual method is what's called the all events test, which is documented as meaning income is includable in gross income when all the events have occurred which fix the right to receive such income. Obviously, for sports and entertainment entities, that test is not met until the games are played or the program and service has been provided. Until then, we believe the right to that income is contingent and not yet fixed. By way of a simplistic example, which we've already heard a couple, but the biggest one that everyone is familiar with is COVID. There had been ticket money collected, and then the entire season and all the games were canceled, and all of those refunds were provided. Another example that might be familiar to some people, specifically to the Vikings, is last year when we were asked to play a home game in London. So people who had purchased various components of that game, that home game, were provided refunds for that game, and no income was recognized. And just a couple points of emphasis, which have already been made, but there is no dispute about whether tax is owed or the amount is owed. All of the teams have been compliant with that remittance since the beginning of time. Doing any other method than accrual would not result in any incremental tax. It would just be the timing of that tax. And just for reference, that timing is meant to be in weeks and months. This is not a year's discussion. So happy to answer any further questions, but again, appreciate your time.
Member questions or comments on the bill? Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the excellent presentation. Certainly this seems to be a very common sense issue. I'm very supportive. But I must say, it also reminds me, in a sense, of some of the bills that we've had before us in this committee recently, which dealt with unrealized capital gains. Kind of a similar idea. You're going to pay taxes on income that hasn't been realized yet. And I think this is an example of a similar faulty, the way this has been interpreted now has been faulty. And I'm very supportive of the correction that you've brought before us.
Other member questions or comments? Senator Frentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just to finalize all this, we're simply asking to clarify something, and I want to make clear, members, this is already the practice of every team. They send in the revenue according to what this Senate file already contains. So we're not changing the way the money comes into the state. We're not changing the liability itself. We're simply saying to the Tax Committee, please make this clear. You'll make everybody happier. And whether you're at that small restaurant in St. Cloud or another sports venue, we want taxpayer certainty. We want them to be able to say, this is when we owe the tax. That has a number of implications. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members.
Senator Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Frentzen. I, too, support what you are looking to do here. It makes sense. It's consistent. It's right. And I apologize for not bringing this question earlier, but it wasn't until I started, till you made your final comments, and I looked at the revenue estimate, and there's an impact here. If indeed the department is, or the teams are paying according to this bill now, why indeed is there a revenue analysis estimate before us? There shouldn't be one, I would expect.
Senator Frentz, you can answer that, and we can also ask the department to come up and advise if that's helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Drazkowski. Essentially, because of the way timing that would shift it into a different fiscal year, fiscal quarter, there is no change the way the money's actually been coming in, and there have been notices from the Department of Revenue to the teams for months and years saying, hey, we disagree about how this works. So in the real world, there would be zero impact, but the fiscal note would tell you, had we received it earlier, it would have affected one fiscal year differently than another. Not the total, but the timing.
And Senator Frentz, you got away with one because Senator Resch is not here, but we call them revenue estimates in this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Frentz.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Frentz, Senate File 3228 is laid over. Senator Rasmussen. Welcome to the committee, Senator Rasmussen. Senate File 2772 is in front of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have the A1 author's amendment that if the committee would consider moving at this time, I would appreciate it.
Senator Weber offers the A1 as an author's amendment. All in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to present Senate File 2772 today. Mr. Chair, I think members of this committee and the legislature appreciate how challenging it can be to keep a family farm going. And there can be lots of stresses that come up with maintaining a family farm, and it can be really hard to transition that family farm to the next generation. And so it's always really rewarding and a point of pride for the folks that I represent when they do have a family farm that they've been able to pass on for generation to generation. One of the tools that Minnesota tax law has to help family farms both stay in their family and then pass on to the next generation is the special agricultural homestead. One of the criteria to qualify for this homestead is that the farmer and the owner must live within four townships of the agricultural property. Mr. Chair, I've heard from a number of constituents, especially in the rural area that I represent, that this can create challenges as those farmers age and need the opportunity to be closer to health care. For example, some of the counties I represent do not have a hospital in the county, but you might have individuals who need to be closer to health care options or need to have other housing options. So the bill before the committee makes a very minor adjustment on how to qualify for the special agricultural homestead. We are moving the proximity rule from within four townships to either residing in the county of the agricultural property or the adjacent county. And this would provide a little bit more flexibility for rural areas where people would be able to still maintain the special agricultural homestead, help utilize that as a tool to keep the family farm in the family while not having to sacrifice access to health care and other needs that the family members might have. Mr. Chair, I do have some testifiers here that would like to tell their story as well.
Wonderful. Welcome to the committee, Mathias family. Mr. Jonathan Mathias, please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Could I defer to Mom? I think she kind of wanted to talk first. Is
you
that
bet.
Possible?
Ms. Mathias, okay, Ms. You. Marilyn Mathias, please introduce yourself and go ahead. Always let Mom talk first.
Right.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning to everyone. My name is Marilyn Mathias. I'm age 77. Since 1969, I've lived on our family farm. It's a century family farm in Minnesota since 1902. And the farm is located near Wheaton, which is in Traverse County, the very western part of Minnesota. For 56 years, I've lived on that farm. It's been my home. And my deepest wish is to pass this farm on to my son, Jonathan, who is sitting to my left. But in 2020, my life changed. My husband passed away, leaving me alone on the farm, which is risky. My son helps clear snow and does a lot of, helps me a lot, keeps me safe if something goes wrong. Wheaton, the nearest community to the farm, their emergency services are stretched, meaning they have an ambulance crew, but it would take probably up to a half hour, 25 minutes to a half hour to reach our location in rural Wheaton. Or if the weather is bad, probably up to an hour for a Browns Valley, Minnesota ambulance to get there. So medical care is limited, but so it makes my living on the farm unsafe to a certain degree. And it also jeopardizes my estate planning with the limitation of having to live on that farm to keep my homestead rights. Current homestead rules make me choose between my health and safety and my farm. Either stay within four townships to keep my homestead status or and critical for tax relief and transferring the farm versus moving for my health and losing those benefits. The SF2772 fixes this. It allows me to move near Alexandria, which is closer for medical care. They have one of the top 100 hospitals in the country. But yet I could keep my homestead status as my son farms the land. By easing these distance limits, this bill supports my health and our farming legacy. So this isn't just a story that I'm telling you. It affects a lot of
generational farmers out in rural Minnesota that are torn between safety and preserving their farms. This 2772 is a practical solution. It's balancing my health, my estate planning, and the family farms. I urge you to pass this bill. It will protect farmers like me and my neighbors and the whole area while living safely and ensuring farms stay in the family for generations. Thank you for listening. I appreciate this opportunity to speak on this bill this morning, and I appreciate the opportunity to voice my story as well as the whole outer area of Minnesota in keeping our farms as our legacy and passing it down to the next generation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Mathias. Mr. Mathias, did you have anything to add? Or?
If I could kind of just thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead and start by introducing yourself.
My name is Jonathan Mathias. I'd like to just kind of talk about what it looks like from my side, trying to hold the farm together for another generation. Like I said, fourth generation farmer, and I feel like since Dad passed away, I'm a little bit of an amateur estate planner, meeting with everybody and trying to see how we can possibly do this. One thing, if Mom has to move away, whenever he talks townships, that might sound a little hard to comprehend. A township's basically 6 miles. So you got about 24 miles you can live from your land. And once you get outside that, it really doesn't matter. You could be Bill Gates, it could be anybody. You lose all the benefits of the 100-and-some years of your family farm, you know? So anyway, looking at it from my angle, how do you hold this thing together? Since it's tied to your home, the second I buy the house from Mom, she's gonna lose homestead if she moves to Alec or close to Alec. And in that moment, we lose the qualified deduction where our estate will be taxable at $3 million instead of $5 million. So that $3 million, taxable at 13%, it comes to $260,000 I gotta come up with within 90 days of Mom passing away. And it's not just $260,000. I have to pay. I don't sell $260,000 of corn and write a check. I sell corn. I pay federal tax, state tax, self-employment tax. And if you don't have the money to do that, if you don't have the corn to sell, you finance it. So instead of $260,000, it's close to $604,000. And you know, when you sit there and look at that on top of all the other costs, and you know, it's not like you can sneak a whole lot of farmland into the tax anymore. Since 2011, it's been at $5 million. Well, back then in Traverse County, you could get 1,240 acres in at that price. Now you're under 500. That's not enough land to even really farm without having to have a job. You're not a full-time farmer, you know? So I guess it puts me in a position where I have to pick between taking that on or having my mom in a kind of a vulnerable position, you know? So for that reason, I think, you know, I talked to Senator Rasmussen here at the Wheaton Library, and we kind of talked about what would be possible. And he came up with this, and I think this makes sense. You know, 24 miles from Wheaton, Minnesota, that's nothing. We're 60 miles from a Walmart. So I think this would work. It's reasonable enough. You're not moving across the state. You're not going to go, I'm going to buy a nice house in Duluth. We'll see you later. You're still attached to the community. You're still close to home. But for how thin resources are getting out there, this kind of helps. So for that reason, I guess that's why I'm here today. Thank you very much for your time.
Good morning, Senator Rasmussen. Thank you very much for bringing your bill. We have one more testifier, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mr. Peterson from the Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation, if you'd identify yourself for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Hunter Peterson, representing the Minnesota Farm Bureau today. Just want to thank Senator Rasmussen for bringing Senate File 2772 forward. We're supportive of the bill. Appreciate the Mathiases being here as well to share their story. I think it's, you know, that's not a situation that anybody should be put in. And I think from the standpoint of our membership and our organization, this is a really common sense, reasonable proposal that I think, you know, not only is it going to help keep family farms in the family, but I think it reflects the reality of living in a rural area in rural Minnesota today. So with that, just wanted to share our support and appreciate you hearing the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Are there questions or comments for Mr. Peterson? Senator Rasmussen, do you have a final comment you'd like to make?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just really want to thank the Mathias family for bringing this issue to my attention and working with the Farm Bureau and others to put together a common sense approach that helps family farms stay within the family. And I think that's a goal that we all share, and this will help alleviate some of the stresses that you heard about today, where families might have to choose between having access to health care and the services they need while being able to maintain their family farm. So I think this is a small, reasonable adjustment that could help families in greater Minnesota.
Thank you, Senator Rasmussen. Senate File 2772 is amended, is laid over. The next bill on our agenda is Senate File 3374, Senator Farnsworth. Senator Farnsworth brings us Senate File 3374. Senator Weber offers the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Farnsworth.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I couldn't hear over the noise. What did you say?
Beg pardon?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you over the noise in the hall.
We adopted your author's amendment. Yeah, sometimes people even outside of the hearing room can't manage to use their inside voices. We're prepared now to hear your presentation of your bill, 3374, as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is a very simple bill. It just increases the expenditure limit for cities of the third class from $3,000 to $10,000 for free musical entertainment for the public. And to tell you more about that, with your permission, Madam Chair, I do have a testifier.
And Senator Farnsworth, who does this, who will it apply to?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In my district, it would apply to the city of Hibbing, and this was a request from
the city. And Senator Farnsworth, I can't hear you. Oh. You need to use your outside voice.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. In my district, this would apply to the city of Hibbing, and it was a request
of
from
Hibbing.
The city.
To Hibbing?
Yes.
Okay. And we have one testifier, the mayor. Please identify yourself and then proceed.
Good morning. I'm Pete Hajduk, mayor of Hibbing. Thank you, Chair Rest, members of the Senate Tax Committee, for allowing me an opportunity to speak to you today. Thank you to Senator Farnsworth for carrying FS3374, a bill supporting free musical entertainment for general public annual expenditure limit expansion provision. This morning, I want to talk to you about something that may not always make the headlines, but absolutely makes a difference in the heart of a community. That's our city band. Our city band is an important component of the quality of life in our community. Supporting a city band isn't about music, it's about the people. It's about creating spaces where families gather in the park on a warm summer night, where kids hear a trumpet for the first time and dream of learning an instrument, where neighbors sit side by side and remember what we all have in common. Culturally, a band, city band, helps preserve our identity. They play the soundtrack to our celebrations, our parades, our civic pride. They carry the spirit of a community in every note. Socially, the band brings people together. Musicians, young and old, from all walks of life, share the same stage, the same purpose. In a world that can feel divided, the band unites us in harmony, literally. And economically, it's a smart investment. Free public concerts draw crowds. Crowds support local businesses. A vibrant art scene makes our city more attractive to tourists, potential residents, and investors. All of this from the power of a few instruments and a little community support. I'm here this morning to request that the general public annual expenditure limit be increased from $3,000 to $10,000 per year. Costs incurred include purchasing new sheet music, performance equipment, and other expenditures. Costs have continued to go up for city bands, not down. Our city band currently has 50 plus members and continually practicing and performing. Our band is one of the oldest continual city bands in the state of Minnesota. With years of great leadership and talented musicians committed to their community, the band has not missed one year performing since 1897. That's 128 years of continual community music. Our city band performs year round at city-led and community events, making itself an integral part of the quality of life in the city of Hibbing. I kindly ask that you consider allowing us to provide more financial assistance than $3,000 per year to help ensure that this legacy and opportunity for our future generations continues. I urge you, let's keep our city band strong. Let's support not just music, but the spirit behind it. Because when the city invests in music, it really invests in the connection, the culture, and the community. An example of the connection in the community is this past winter, our high school boys hockey team was at the state tournament, and our high school band was down there with them. Our basketball team also advanced to the semifinals and the region finals. Our local city band stepped up and performed for them at their playoffs. So that's what community pride is all about, and what I don't want to lose and want to support. Again, thank you, Chair Rest, members, for the opportunity for your consideration, and I would happily answer any questions at this time. Thank you.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Farnsworth and Mayor, I'm perfectly fine with your bill. My question is, why do we limit it anyway?
To protect the taxpayer from them bringing in Taylor Swift.
Madam Chair, I think it's called a local election. if I was mayor, if I had tried to do something like that, I wouldn't have been mayor that much longer.
And who's to say that wouldn't have been a good thing?
Well, who knows? Anyway,
this discussion has nothing to do with you, Senator Farnsworth. Are there any questions or comments for Senator Farnsworth or the mayor? Thank you, sir. Seeing none, then Senator Farnsworth, a fairly simple request, Senate File 3374. As amended, is laid over.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your time. Thank you.
You bet. Senator Housechild. Senate File 1683. There is an A2 amendment. A2 amendment, Senator Klein offers the A2 amendment to Senate File 1683. Oops, this is a mistake. It is 16, your bill number is, it's on the agenda incorrectly. It is 1633. Mm-hmm. That is an amendment proposed by Senator Klein. although on behalf of the author. Well, I guess, Senator Housechild, you can do it yourself. Senator Housechild moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, say no. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Housechild.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Tax Committee. Today we're here to talk about forest management and forest lands tax classification. Forest provides a host of benefits for Minnesotans. They clean our air and water, provide food and habitat for wildlife, give us raw materials to make wood products we use every day, mitigate the effects of climate change, and offer beautiful places to explore and find solitude. Loss of forest area poses an increased threat to Minnesota's natural resources, communities, and economy. As forests fragment and disappear, so do the benefits they provide. By helping landowners keep the forest as forest, we encourage sustainable management and preserve forest benefits for all Minnesotans. Conservation easements and property tax incentives are key tools used to help forest landowners maintain woodlands, protect forest benefits, and avoid conversions to other uses such as development of agriculture. This proposal clarifies eligibility for one such incentive, the 2C Managed Forest Lands Property Tax Classification. The Minnesota Department of Revenue administers this, which authorizes Class 2C and the associated reduced tax rate of 0.65%. The 2C classification is applied to property by county assessors. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources verifies that the land proposed for Class 2C is guided by a forest management plan as defined in the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act. However, over the past few years, there have been inconsistencies in the application of Class 2C to forest lands with conservation easements. Some county assessors consider such lands eligible for Class 2C, while some do not, based on how the statute is written. The latter interpretation, i.e. that lands with conservation easements are ineligible, provides a disincentive for landowners to put their lands under conservation easements, which are a key tool to protecting wildlife habitat, water quality, and cultural benefits of forest lands. The decision to protect land into perpetuity with a conservation easement is significant. Like all forest-managed decisions, private forest landowners seek confidence in the financial impacts of a conservation easement as they weigh their options. Currently, forest landowners who are considering or having an existing conservation easement face uncertainty about their property tax classification and the eligibility of Class 2C. This proposal simply amends that to clarify that forest lands with a conservation easement are eligible for Class 2C tax incentives. And with that, Madam Chair, I do have a couple of testifiers.
Senator Housechild, I need you to actually, since this is a delete everything amendment, would you go to the language that's in your delete everything amendment that is why we're here.
Madam Chair, I apologize. I don't have the delete all right in front of me. It looks like I have the original bill, so if I might go to my folder and get it quick, I can take a look at it.
Sure.
I believe it was just a technical. It might have been a delete all, but
Mr. Berggren will bring it to you.
Sure, sure.
And so we'll start with one of your testifiers,
sure.
And then the first one, and then we'll come back to making sure
good.
We understand the language.
Sure.
It's a lot of pages here, but there's only four lines that are
right.
being added. Mr. Ostley, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Yeah, Chair Rest and Senators, my name is Wayne Ostley. I am the Director of Land Protection with the Minnesota Land Trust. Minnesota Land Trust holds about 750 conservation easements, protecting more than 85,000 acres of Minnesota's priority natural habitats and treasure lakes across the state. A significant number of these conservation easements are owned by landowners that have forest land associated with them. Many of these are also enrolled in 2C managed forest tax classification. This bill is important for sustaining our state's natural resources and private forest lands. Tax classification 2C for managed forest is an important tool to help preserve Minnesota's critical forest lands by helping family forest owners recognize property tax adjustments if their property meets certain eligibility requirements. Tax assessors across the state have for years recognized the eligibility of conserved property to also be enrolled in 2C classification. In fact, these tools were designed to work hand in glove together. However, the language governing program eligibility has been a bit unclear and needs to be modified to eliminate confusions among landowners and local assessors. At present, we know of two counties that do not recognize eligibility for landowners with conservation easements. Senate Bill SF-1633 helps clarify the language that determines a program's eligibility, including confirming that a property may be eligible for 2C classification if it also has a conservation easement placed on it. This bill brings eligibility for managed forests in alignment with Green Acres and Rural Preserve 2A and 2B agriculture tax classifications. These ag tax classifications and easements are compatible, and 2C was simply meant to be a parallel program for forest owners to give them a tax classification that previously did not exist. We believe SF-1633 achieves this simple fix, which will strengthen the program and thus strengthen Minnesota's forest resources.
Thank you, Mr. Ostley. Senator Hochschild, I believe you do have the DE amendment. If you would just take us to the language, I believe it's all going to be on page 2, and just explain what it does there so that we're all clear.
Yes, Madam Chair. So you'll see the section 2.6 and 2.7 is where they just clarify the chapter and subdivision that they're referring to with an approved plan writer. And then 2.19 to 2.21 is really the heart of what we're talking about, which is just clarifying that an easement is still eligible, a conservation easement is still eligible for 2C classification.
So a conservation easement does not spoil the treatment of you're proposing. But is it most for 2C, but is it mostly because it's not in there, or was it deliberately in the beginning decided that conservation easement designations would not be considered that? Was it a deliberate thing, or was it just overlooked, and what's changed?
Yep, so this, thank you, Madam Chair, for the question, and I think you're getting to the heart of the issue. So it was never the intent that conservation easements were to not qualify for 2C. This is simply clarifying for county, for the counties that they can, in fact, include conservation easements in this designation.
Thank you very much for that explanation. Your other testifier, Mr. Michael, welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record.
Yeah, Chair, members, my name is Gary Michael. I'm the Cooperative Forest Management Supervisor for DNR Division of Forestry, and it is my honor to be here in front of leaders of the state. Appreciate the time. I don't have a whole lot more to add, but I'll go through it in case not everyone is familiar with the statute. The purpose of the 2C land classification, like 290C or SFIA, is to maintain healthy forests on the landscape for all the benefits they provide to Minnesota's residents, from clean air, clean water, wildlife habitat, to wood products and everything in between. 2C and SFIA provide incentives to help private forest landowners maintain healthy, sustainable woods, and a forest management plan is a foundational tool to help that landowner with their management work. As Senator Hochschild shared, the bill clarifies that lands with a conservation easement are eligible for 2C. Conservation easements are acquired because they provide public benefit on private land. Average size of conservation easement held by family woodland owners is about 50 acres, although they can range in size. This issue was brought to our attention by private consulting foresters, landowners, and nonprofits that now comprise the 2C and conservation easement working group. We are pleased to have found a resolution to their concern. The Department of Revenue has also been engaged. Department of Revenue staff are aware of the proposed change and have indicated it provides the clarity needed. And that's really all I have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Seeing none, Senator Hochschild, do you have any final comment? Then Senate File 1633, as amended, will be laid over. Our next bill is Senate File 3364, Senator Putnam. And Senator Putnam, I understand that your testifier is on Zoom. When he begins his testimony, you may want to sit at the table over here so that you can see him, because otherwise you can't.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a good idea.
Senate File 3364, Senator Putnam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to discuss Senate File 3364. This bill would provide some relief and a fair playing field for community banks. Community banks, many of which serve farmers in greater Minnesota, struggle to compete with credit unions and other providers of credit. This provision would simply treat these banks as we treat other financial institutions that do this work of this variety and at this scale. The bill itself simply has two very basic provisions. Section 1 states that a financial institution that is an S-corp can subtract income from tax calculation when the value of that loan is less than $5 million. Section 2 makes the same language intervention, but at a different portion in statute. The bill is very simple, Madam Chair, so I don't really have much else to say.
Very simple and very expensive.
Extremely expensive, Madam Chair. I'm not going to pretend like it's not.
But, you know, I really do think that it is important, even when we know that there is a fairly big number of tax relief that is proposed. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be looking at these bills just to see what the impact of it would be if we think that the policy in and of itself is a good one. So I'm sure you're aware of that. With that in mind, we turn to your testifier, Mr. Hurgis. And he is on Zoom, I believe. Mr. Hurgis, are you there?
He's got to unmute himself.
Can you hear me, Mr. Hurgis?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
If you would speak a little bit louder, that would be great.
Yes, I'll do that.
If you would now then identify yourself for the record, please give your testimony.
Thank you. Chair Rest and members, for the record, my name is John Hurgis, and I am CEO of Falcon National Bank, headquartered in St. Cloud, Minnesota. We also have banks in Foley, Richmond, Maple Grove, Ham Lake, and Isanti, Minnesota. I am testifying today on behalf of Bank in Minnesota and its 170 community bank members across Minnesota. Community banks in Minnesota are as unique as each of the communities they serve, but they all have one common goal, and that is to use their role as an independent community bank to make positive impact on their neighborhoods, towns, and cities. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 3364. And to thank Senator Putnam for authoring this bill, as well as Senator Weber for being co-author. We believe this legislation will cause additional investments in agriculture and small businesses throughout Minnesota. Senate File 3364 would exempt income derived from commercial and agricultural loans of $5 million or less from state income tax. The idea for this bill comes from Wisconsin, where Governor Tony Evers signed a similar exemption into law as part of their 2023 biennial budget. Fellow community bankers in Wisconsin, as well as Bank in Minnesota members with banks in Wisconsin, have already successfully utilized this exemption to retain growing small businesses and family farms, as it allows the banks to price their loans at rates that are competitive with tax-exempt entities like Compeer Financial and credit unions. Community banking is increasingly difficult as we struggle to cover tight loan margins and compete with the growing population of tax-exempt institutions. This legislation movement toward tax parity would allow community banks to turn this tax exemption into more competitive loan terms for their Main Street customers. Again, I'd like to thank Chair Rest for hearing and Senator Putnam for authoring this bill, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Hurgis. Senator Putnam. Senator Putnam, final comments.
Thank you very much for taking the opportunity to discuss this issue. And thanks to my friend John for zooming in.
Thank you, Senator Huttman. Putnam, Senate Files 3364 is laid over.
Welcome to the committee, Chair Rest. Senate File 2849 is before the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm presenting this bill today on behalf of Senator Westrum. And in order to do that, I needed to and gladly did sign on as a co-author. However, I know nothing about milk processing facilities, except the one that Senator Westrum is trying to accommodate in this bill is very large. And that, as I understand it, there is a sales tax exemption for agricultural processing materials, but the law does not include milk processing facilities, and Senator Westrum is asking for that to be included, and these are if you look at the bill summary, these are very, very large investments in excess of $100 million. So what the bill does is, with regard to the current law, it's, and I'm looking at summary, that it strikes the cross-reference to the definition of agricultural processing facility materials and creates a new definition that would include the facilities that process or produces milk. So it's not changing the exemption, it's adding to what is being proposed. I will point out, because we have done that pointed that out on more than one occasion, but the we occasionally, and we have done it, we did it with these in the current law, have provided sales tax exemptions for private businesses. and the current exemption applies to a private business. It is not an exemption for a project being undertaken by a local government. And there have been more than one occasion where we have deemed it in the public interest to grant those a sales tax exemption to a private business, and that is the case here in this proposal. It does, as I understand it, however, only likely to apply to this one one facility. Although, of course, there could be more in the future. So, Mr. Chairman and members, there is also a letter in your packets from Minnesota Agriculture Growth about this bill, and I direct your attention to it.
Thank you, Senator Rest. I see the letter. You have one testifier, Mr. Solstrom. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you, Senator Rest, so much for presenting this bill. For the record, I'm Lucas Solstrom, Executive Director of the Minnesota Milk Producers Association, and thanks for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 2849 today. And really want to thank Senator Rest for stepping in here for Senator Westrom, who researched and found that this ag processing bill already existed. This is a credit we'd been asking for decades in my whole tenure at Minnesota Milk. This ag processing bill, which did not apply to milk previously, we think is a great solution. So we're essentially, as Senator Rest said, adding the word milk. We are codifying the definition, adding the word milk to that definition today. And I just want to lay out and emphasize how a new large-scale dairy processing plant would be transformational for Minnesota. We have about 70 dairy plants across the state today compared to 470 in Wisconsin, but only 19 take raw milk at scale for processing. So adding just one, like the two recently announced, there's a Daisy plant in southwest Iowa, was a $627 million plant, or a $1.2 billion plant in Chobani, in New York State, excuse me. In both cases, our state was not considered. I have the pleasure or displeasure sometimes of meeting with developers over coffee or more conceptual non-disclosure agreements, and Minnesota quite literally is not on their map for considering. These would add these types of plants add 3 to 9 million pounds of milk needed per day. That's 1 to 3 billion pounds of milk per year, and would likely be additive, generating $200 to $600 million in farm milk sales alone in Minnesota. That's 43,000 to 130,000 cows additional. We have 450,000 cows today in Minnesota, and that's down from our height of a little over 1 million some decades ago. So those cows, farms, and jobs would send a ripple, or really probably a wave of impact to several industries across agriculture in regions of greater Minnesota, and would likely also, as they have in the past, impact marketing, logistics, and sales jobs in the Twin Cities metro area. The economic data is clear. Dairy already contributes over 93,000 jobs and $29.7 billion in total economic impact in Minnesota. Yet, production and processing growth has lagged some of our area states, places as diverse as Michigan, up 75% over three decades, and South Dakota up 27% over the same time, because they have invested in these public-private type partnerships and smart tax policy to attract new plants with the cows and the milk to follow. So finally, Senate File 2849 sends the right signal that Minnesota is open for dairy processing investment. And as I talk to farmers and, as I said, international processors, we just simply aren't on the map, and I hope this bill could move us forward to being there. Thank you so much for your support.
Thank you, Mr. Solstrom. You mentioned that it would increase milk and it would increase cows. Do you have numbers on how many jobs? Apparently, as Senator Rest inference, this would maybe apply to one facility. What are we talking in terms of employment for that?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. In terms of the particular plant that the Department of Revenue is looking at, I don't know the particulars of that plant. As I said, we've been looking at this for a few decades. I know that processing plants of this scale, if you've got a $100 million plant, you're going to see a minimum of 40 direct jobs created through that plant. All right, but it could be hundreds and hundreds more. It just depends on what they're processing and how it's created, and that doesn't always include milk truck drivers. If there's new farms built as a result, if there's, again, marketing or other jobs created, but that's just kind of the plant processing, Mr. Chair, as I understand it.
Other questions from the committee? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just comment that, you know, in the ag industry, milk production is one of those elements that has declined over a period of years to a substantial extent. When I was growing up in Rock County, there were at least three dairy farms around the farm in which I resided. Today, there I don't know that there's three dairy farms in the entire county. And it is a substantial decline in an industry that, quite frankly, is very beneficial to the agricultural picture of Minnesota.
Other questions or comments from the committee? Senator Rest?
No, that's it.
Senate File 2849 will be laid over. Thank you so much. We move now, Senator Rest, to Senate File 2915.
Mr. Chairman, last year, with regard to the issues that Senate File 2915 is addressing, there was a court case that was decided in favor of Alliance, that the property that they were providing to meet their mission as a public charity should be considered under the property tax exemption. And the Supreme Court ruled in their favor, and so we were left with a situation to try and address where I think most of us, and including the county and Alliance itself, the biggest concern was what kind of financial impact there would be on the tenants. The property, which is housing, but as being exempt, doesn't qualify even to start with then as 4D, which has a very low tax rate. Instead, so it would be zero. Tenants in those apartments would therefore not be eligible for the renter's credit because they would instead be assessed personal property tax. And the I think there was a pause in addressing those issues, but not a real solution. In the governor's tax bill, as I recall, and I did not have the opportunity to really look at it again, but as and Ms. Pollack can correct me, but the governor's bill coming from the Department of Revenue was simply to, I believe, make those folks eligible for the renter's credit based on their personal property tax, or was it slightly different than that? Maybe Mr. Sylvia. I didn't have it at home with me, so I couldn't look it up.
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest and members, so under current law, exempt property that is held for a lease of a term of 1 year or more, that's when the tenants would pay, a personal property tax in the amount of the tax that would have been assessed had it been owned by the and used by the private owner. What the governor's proposal did, however, was say that that personal property tax is not assessed for leases of any term of residential rental housing property that is exempt under this institution of purely public charity. So it would specifically say that a personal property tax is not assessed.
Senator Rest.
What this bill does, and I draw your attention to the, there's a memo from the Department of Revenue from last July, as well as the language of the bill. But I think if you look on the second page of the revenue estimate, it's kind of a side-by-side of what the current law is. Then we just heard what the governor may be proposing, and then under this proposal. And what it does is to assert that Alliance and not its tenants would be liable for property taxes on the court-exempted properties beginning with taxes payable in 2025, and that for this year, however, no tax would be due on those court-exempted Alliance properties. But beginning next year, those properties would be taxable as 4D and not apartment property, which would then lower the net tax capacity taxes by a factor of 5. And that would shift the property taxes away from Alliance properties and onto all other property, including homesteads, increasing state paid homeowner property tax refunds by about $10,000. Current law and this proposal would still say that the tenants would not be eligible for the renter's credit on their 2025 income tax returns. That would be filed next year, of course, based on rent paid this year, because no property tax is due. And you don't get the renter's credit unless you have part of your rent is attributable to property taxes on the building and your unit. But that in 2026, the tenants would be eligible for the renter's credit based on rent actually paid in 2026 and the returns filed in 2027. And Mr. Chairman, I bring this proposal because I think we need a solution. I don't quite frankly know that this is the one, but I thought it was important that the committee hear this, because we are going to, I'm sure, be dealing with it for more than just this this session yet once again. And it's been extremely difficult. It was difficult last year to balance the rightful interests of the county and the impact on property that was previously deemed to be subject to the property tax and its tenants eligible for the renter's credit to one that is not. And as I recall the discussions before, it is quite clear, or in my mind, as I heard the testimony, that that the courts have declared that the Alliance and perhaps any other company that operates in the same way, with its mission being a public charity, will ask to be treated the same way. That is, those units that serve the mission are not subject to the are not subject to property tax. But the complicating impact is that by law, those folks otherwise, those tenants, would have to pay a personal property tax, and by law, that would not be that could not be offset by the renter's credit. So that was the conundrum that the outcome of this case placed upon us. So with that, Mr. Chairman, and I seldom introduce a bill and put the words after it by request, but that should be seen as the presentation of this bill. Here's one idea, and we can discuss and talk over and with the other body what should be the proper solution. So I hope that you will hear it in that regard, rather than I being necessarily an advocate for this approach as opposed to being an advocate for finding a good solution for all the parties involved.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Mr. Josh Hoogland, please come forward and introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest. My name is Josh Hoogland. I am the Hennepin County Assessor, but I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. Thank you. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, representing assessors across the state of Minnesota. I'm here to voice support for this proposal that prevents assessors from having to tax low-income individuals and families. As Senator Rest mentioned, the Alliance Housing Court decision exempted charitable housing operators, but as far as assessors are concerned, there's a few considerations that we now have to consider in light of that. The first that I want to mention is the 2023 legislative session enacted policy that reduced the class rate on 4D, and in Hennepin County, just to highlight what that did for operators, the 2024 total tax collection on 4D property was about $30.5 million. And just based on that policy change, that reduced to $14.7 million. So there was a tax reduction year over year based on that change. And then as Senator Rest mentioned, assessors aren't yet precluded of having to tax tenants because of that exemption. When assessors review exempt properties and identify another use outside of the owner's use, we first typically look to the statute 272.01, which requires private use of a exempt property for profit to then be taxed on a personal property account, which means we're placing a personal liability on that user of the property. In a case like this, it's not a for-profit user, but as somewhat of a backstop, we then look at 273.19, which then requires us to review other characteristics of the use of the property and then potentially also tax that use. And in this case, 273.19 is the statute that's in play that would require assessors to then place those personal property accounts directly on tenants. At this point, there are several dozen that have already received valuation notices for the 25 assessment and will be liable for taxes in 2026. I can speak for myself, but I'm sure that it's the case for other assessors across the state. I also have exemption applications currently in my queue that I'm holding on until we get additional guidance from the legislature. The last point that I want to mention is if a property is 4D and then becomes exempt, we then look at the tenant, and if we tax the tenant because they're not a low-income housing operator, they don't qualify for that reduced 4D rate, which means we would then be taxing them at the apartment 1.25% or residential non-homestead 1% rate, the higher rate with the same use. I also want to highlight that this law impacts every county in the state. Every county in the state has low-income housing. Every county in the state has 4D property, which means it is a statewide concern. And then I just want to end by highlighting that MAAO supports a solution to this so that we may not tax low-income individuals.
Thank you, Mr. Hoogland. And online, I think we have Mr. Ben Thomas. Can you hear me, Mr. Thomas?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Please introduce yourself. Give me 30 seconds, and then I'll have you go ahead.
Thank you.
Mr. Thomas, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Chair Klein and members of the committee, my name is Ben Thomas. I'm the Deputy County Assessor for St. Louis County. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on behalf of St. Louis County. We support the language proposed in this bill, which would clarify state law and policy regarding the taxation of residential properties owned and leased by institutions of purely public charity following the Alliance Housing and Hennepin County decision. In St. Louis County, this decision has already resulted in the exemption of a $5.2 million apartment in the city of Duluth, with an additional $3.6 million apartment property presently under petition in tax court. For us, the potential for further exemption of property could extend to over $200 million of 4D low-income housing classified property. All of this tax burden would be shifted to other county taxpayers. As Mr. Hoogland has explained, state law requires the taxation of these leases, and this was the subject of a Department of Revenue memo to assessors last year. For us, it was not possible to set up individual property accounts for tenants in these exempted properties, as the exempted property owner was not required by law to provide other information to the county assessor. When we requested this information, they refused to provide it. Prior to the Alliance decision, residential properties that also provided services to the occupants of the property were eligible to qualify for property tax exemption. The proposed language in Senate File 2915 would codify this requirement and would best support property tax base administration and stability statewide going forward. I join with my assessor colleagues and others who urge you to act favorably on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Do we have questions or comments from the committee? I'm just going to wait until Senator Rest back at the chair. Senator Rest, any closing comments on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When these issues were first brought forward, it was Alliance in this case, they made it quite clear that if there was any attempt to provide carve-outs that would still subject them to any kind of tax, that they would, again, sue the state of Minnesota or sue the county in which an assessor had made that determination. I'm disappointed that there is not someone here from Alliance or from other affected entities that quite frankly, it's not being part of the solution, and that's very disappointing. We'll see where it goes in our deliberations with the other body in conference, and not sure, quite frankly, what path to a solution at this point I'm going to recommend to you all, but this is a very serious challenge for us, particularly if we want to protect as much as possible the poor, who are generally the ones who are occupying these non-taxable apartments provided by an entity of public charity.
Thank you, Senator Rest. And with that, Senate File 2915 will be laid over. I know you have announcements, Senator Rest. Before we go to that, I have one announcement of my own.
Of course.
Which is that this committee wishes you a very happy birthday. I know 39 will treat you well. Senator yes. Rest.
Thank you very much. That's very kind and gracious of you. We will be having hearings next week. The agenda is not set. We're still waiting word for when the House is going to be taking up their tax bill. We typically, even though we're certainly, and I've been talking to many of you, working on what provisions will be in ours, we wait for them not only to, because they must act first to send it over, but to what they are laying out as their bill, so that in some ways our bill is always a comment, it's always an editorial on what they are proposing as we then go forward to meet in conference. And with that, Mr. Chairman, you may adjourn the committee.
Committee is adjourned.